morning, friends, and welcome to KFAR Radio's Meet a Pioneer. Today is January 11th, 1985. I'm Gail Malloy. Each Friday morning at 9 o'clock, we meet a pioneer. We'll spend the next hour with Mr. Earl Cook. He is best known for his work in real estate in Fairbanks. This morning's presentation is sponsored by the Two Rivers Lodge, the Riverboat Discovery, Sophie Station, Larson's Jewelers, Denali Chiropractic, Interior Signs, and our newest sponsor, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank, and the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. We'll begin our program in just a moment. Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop. Sam and Jane McConkie believe beautiful things are timeless, and everything you find at the Forget-Me-Not Shop is beautiful. Fine linens, silver, crystal, decorator items for your home or office, and that little something for special friends. Forget-Me-Not adds a feeling of luxury to even the most practical items. So, for beautiful things for years to come, for your friends, your home, or for yourself, remember the Forget-Me-Not Gift Shop, open 10 to 6, 6 days a week in Northgate Square. Good morning, Mr. Earl Cook.
Good morning, Gail.
It's nice to have you here today. You've been in Fairbanks a long time, since 1938?
That's right, March of 38.
You were born February 23rd, 1913.
13, yes.
So you're getting close to a 70...
72, almost.
72nd birthday, my. Well, before we get into some of the stories that you have from the Fairbanks area, what were the circumstances of you coming up here? Tell us a little bit about your life before then and where you came from.
Well, I was born in a little town, Nebish, in northern Minnesota, and lived there until I was in second year in high school. And there were three of us in the family, my older brother and a younger sister. And our family sort of disintegrated, and by the time I was ready for high school, I could no longer stay in northern Minnesota, and a family from Waconia, Minnesota, said that I could come and live with them while I went to high school. So I worked, I lived with them and babysat, and then I worked in the filling station while I was in high school. And of course, I graduated in 1930 at the age of 17, and at that time, it was a Great Depression, and there wasn't any work. But I had saved enough money to go 1 year at the University of Minnesota, and I worked the following summer then, and in the fall, I got in another quarter, and then I ran out of money, and there was just, really, couldn't make it in school. So I decided that I would just take to the road, and I'd never done that before, but I did, and a fellow that I had met, or a friend that I had in high school, decided he'd go with me, so we took off riding the rails and headed west, and I never will forget the first time we tried to hop off a train. It wasn't too bad getting on, but getting off when they don't stop was a little problem. And he had a brother in Plentywood, Montana, who was training to be a pilot for Northwest Airlines. And we wanted to stop and see him on our way west. And when the train went through Plentywood, it didn't stop. And we jumped off, and I thought, sure, I was going to go under the train. And we hadn't learned at that time how to jump off of one that's moving. We jumped off and went along with it, and you should jump off and turn to your right and go the other way. And both of us almost fell under it. But it was an interesting experience. We stayed in Plentywood for a while, and then we moved on west and picked oranges and apples and shocked grain and worked and sent our money home in hopes that the next year we'd be able to go back to school. Well, when I got home the next year, and I had sent my money to my brother and sister, and they had needed it more than I did, so they had spent it, so I took off again.
Oh, my.
And worked my way back west and went to work in Idaho. And I stayed there with an aunt and uncle for a while. And I milked cows and went to the College of Idaho and worked in the summer. And then that petered out, so I went into Boise and enrolled in business school and worked in a cafe as a dishwasher to begin with, and finally ended up as a cook in this little cafe because the health inspection people decided the woman who owned it had TB and she could no longer run it. So for a few months, I was a short order cook in a restaurant.
Oh, my goodness.
And I finally finished school and went to work in Boise for a while, and that's where I met my wife, and we were married there in 36.
1936.
And I was working for the Union Pacific Railroad and got bumped from one job to another and finally ended up in Los Angeles, where we spent the winter of 38. And by that time, my sister and brother had come to Alaska, and they knew we were having a problem down there, and so they arranged to help us get to Fairbanks, and that's how we get here. We came up on the old Alaska steam, and at that time, the menus on the steamship were all the pictures of dogs done by Josephine Crumrine, and I never did keep any of those menus, but this fall when we went out to the potlatch in Seattle, I met Josephine and asked her if she had a set of the menus, and she said yes, and so now I have a full set of her menus illustrated with the dog heads that she did.
The steamship menus were illustrated with the artwork, huh?
Yes.
Oh, my. Now, during the 30s, you were fortunate to be working for Pacific Railway, but the problem was, you got bumped. Is this because of the depression?
It was the depression, as they laid off people, seniority took precedence, so you could be bumped from a fairly good job to a lesser job, That's what happened to us, and we just got bumped from Idaho to California, and then there wasn't any. We both worked there for a while, but when they finally laid me off at Union Pacific, then we came to Alaska.
So 1938, you're, in a sense, still a newlywed, just a couple of years. You come to Fairbanks, Alaska. Well, what was your first days like here?
Well, it was kind of interesting. On the boat and train coming up, there was a woman on the train who was very, very ill, and she was really quite obnoxious. And my brother and sister had arranged to rent us a house, which was right down back of the post office on 3rd Avenue, and it was a little two-story house. Well, when we got on the train, then from Seward to Fairbanks, this same lady was on there, and we didn't know who she was, but she was quite ill when we got to Fairbanks. They took her directly to St. Joseph's, and we went to this little house my brother and sister rented for us. And it seemed the fellow that there was actually the husband, or you could say a pimp, because I'm not sure that he was married to this gal. We found out she was from the line later. But anyway, she didn't know that he had rented this house to us. So after a few days in the hospital, she decided to come home, and he still hadn't told her, and then she found out we were living in the house, and it was quite an experience for us, because we had to move out. We didn't have any place to go, but we did find another little log cabin right close there. So when we went back to try to, my brother went back, trying to get the money back from the guy that he'd paid the rent to, and he said he didn't have it, and anyway, he and his wife, or whoever she was, got in an argument, and he took a shot at her and grazed her, and my brother came back all shook up, and he couldn't get his money back, and that was our introduction to Fairbanks.
Well, how did you and Pat, did you think you were going to stay?
Oh, yes, we hadn't. There wasn't anything else for us to do.
That
we
wasn't
going to
scare you off.
No.
Ooh, gee whiz. Well, what did you find work right away?
Well, in about 2 weeks, I went to work for the FE company over in the office at the FE company, which was, of course, across the river. And I worked there for 5 years. And then, of course, by that time, the war had broken out. And I worked there 2 years for 2 years until 1943. And that was 2 years after the war broke out.
What did you do for the FE company?
I worked in the office.
Yeah, and office work, huh?
Yeah, just office work. And I had to do some field work also, driving and go out to the different camps and take messages and see that they got their orders every day.
Now, were you still living in your cabin? at this during these years?
No, we lived in the cabin for, we moved into the place, and of course we were expecting our first child, and we wanted to fix it up, and we cleaned it up and painted it, and the landlady would come to get the rent, and every time she came, she'd look at it and say, "Oh my, this, you've done so nice, and it looks so nice in here, I'll have to raise your rent." So the third time she did that, we decided we'd try to build a house for ourselves, and this was in 39, and we started negotiating with the lumber supply to try to get a loan to build a home. And in the meantime, we moved out of the cabin into an apartment down on 2nd Avenue, which was the Burns Apartments at the time, right by the co-op. So we lived there through the winter and of 39 and 40, and in the spring of 40, we moved into our home, where we still are.
What were your first couple of winters like? Were they particularly hard or surprising to you? Or?
No, they really weren't hard. We were busy, and of course, we were much younger then, and we had you made your own entertainment. It was just one of those things, and we really thoroughly enjoyed it.
Who were some of your closest friends then?
Well, there were on the boat coming up, there were some people by the name of Jack and Elsie Greaves, and there was a lady by the name of Ann Strand who had gone out to have a baby, and she was on the way back. And then I met a young fellow on the boat whose name was Jack Bullock, and he was in steerage. That was an interesting part of it. If he paid $5 to the steward, he could come and eat at the table in the dining room. So I invited him to come to our table, eat with this gang of us, unfortunately, about the first day he was going to eat with us, we hit the Gulf, and I got seasick. And I never did eat a meal at the table with Jack, but anyway, he got off at Cordova and flew to wherever he was going. But later, Jack was in Nome, and he married Edith Bullock. You've probably heard of Edith, and they had the barge line. I saw Jack several times later.
When you all came up at that time, you had no idea what you'd all end up be doing with your lives.
Well, of course, the Greaves were on the way back as seasonal workers for the F.E. Company.
Uh-huh.
Ann Strand's husband was a miner. And then there was a whole group of us. Jane Gordon from Gordon's, her parents had Gordon's store. She was on the boat. We landed in Seward, and we were all broke. Nobody had any money. And my brother was supposed to send us some money in to the Mount McKinley Hotel. And when we got there in the evening, we asked them if some money was there, because we were all hungry. We didn't have anything to eat. And they said, no, nothing had come. So we all went to bed. And then about 10 o'clock or later, I don't know how late it was, a fellow came from the desk, came up and said that the money had arrived. And we went down and got some money, and then we invited the people to go to dinner with us. Well, we got downstairs and the dining room was closed. We couldn't eat anyway. But when we landed in Fairbanks, there was a fellow by the name of Cy Thine on the trip with us. And we got off the train here and got out on the platform. And he turned to me and he said, "Earl, I got a penny left. You take it." He says, "I want to be completely broke when I get here." So that was our introduction to Fairbanks. Well, anyway, we met a lot of young people that evening because my sister had, well, the Miller family, there was a bunch of those. Emma Miller, she's still a very close friend now, Emma Vasquez, and several other young people. So we had quite a group of young people that we met right off the bat, so it made it easier for us.
We're talking with Mr. Earl Cook on KFAR's Meet a Pioneer. We'll be back in just a moment after we acknowledge some of our sponsors.
Alaskans have always been famous for their hospitality. The same wonderful hospitality you still find at the Two Rivers Lodge, where Don and Stasha Troutman offer the best menu and interior, a comfortable, quiet atmosphere, and that famous Alaskan welcome to the people who are today's history makers. If you've been meaning to try one of the most talked-about dining experiences in the Alaskan interior, don't wait any longer. Go out tonight to the Two Rivers Lodge, 16 Mile Chena Hot Springs Road.
Meet a Pioneer is sponsored in part by Interior Signs, long established as one of the interior's most professional, most dependable year-round sign makers. They're licensed, insured, and always ready to serve Fairbanks with signs of every kind. Signs for business, contracting, or creative design. So for signs that stand the test of time, call Interior Signs at 479-3859. That's 479-3859. Interior Signs at 2405 South Cushman.
Twenty years ago, Mount McKinley Bank was founded by a group of forward-looking individuals who saw a need in the community. The new bank offered low-interest loans to encourage new home building in the Fairbanks area. It was an immediate success. Today, Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is still located at 530 4th Avenue in the same building where founder Julian Rice and first president Judge Vernon Forbes served on the first board of trustees. The bank has seen a lot of history, and their solid background of investment and involvement in the community has earned Mount McKinley their own place in Fairbanks history. Mount McKinley Mutual Savings Bank is proud to sponsor Meet a Pioneer. At Mount McKinley, they're looking forward to a future past.
You're listening to Meet a Pioneer. I'm talking with Mr. Earl Cook. Well, Earl, I want to back up just a moment. When you were working for the FE company, do you remember about what you made then? What was the going wage?
Well, I think I started out about $150 a month.
How did that compare? Was that good money, or?
I really don't know. I wasn't well enough acquainted in Fairbanks. It seemed like good money to me after not having worked for several months. And it wasn't, you didn't live in luxury on it, that's for sure.
Uh-huh.
But my wife went to work also, and
where did Pat work?
She worked for the Fairbanks Insurance Agency to start with.
So even after you had children, she continued to work?
She worked until 1947, yes.
What'd you do with the children? What was their daycare or something?
No, we had a babysitter, and we had live-in babysitters part of the time, and then we had a gal downtown who was very good with the children, and we took them there.
Uh-huh. When did you decide to build your own home?
We decided to build in 1938. That's when we decided we wanted to build, but actually we got started in 1939. And at that time, the only bank here was First National, and they weren't handling FHA loans because that's the way we had to do an FHA because we didn't have any money. And Nick Nussbaumer from Fairbanks Lumber was very helpful, and he helped us get a loan through the Bank of Ketchikan. And we put the bids out on the first bids we put out on the house were beyond what we could afford for the income we had. So we asked Nick to resubmit the bids, and which he did, and we made no changes, but they came back at $4,000 lower than the original bid, so we were able to go ahead and start the house.
And how much money was that about? What did you start it at?
At $8,000.
$8,000. And where did you build?
In Slaterville. And we were the third house in the whole Slaterville area.
The Slaterville, for those listening that aren't familiar or fairly new, is
just north.
Minnie.
Yeah, Minnie Street is the main street through Slaterville. Of course,
uh-huh.
At the time we built, Minnie Street was just, they were all just dirt roads like all the places were in Fairbanks at that time. And it was a field, really, the old Slater homestead. And he had cleared off part of it and sold off lots, and we had bought two lots from him.
Charlie Slater.
From Charlie Slater,
uh-huh.
Yes.
And it was just a field?
Just a field, and there were no trees left. He had cleared everything off.
Uh-huh.
But just behind where we built, or just beyond Minnie Street, it was all still open. That hadn't been cleared yet.
So this was out of town?
It was out of town, and our friend said, oh, what do you want to build clear out there for, you know? Which we now say to the young people who want to go clear out in the hills, you know, but at that time that seemed a long ways out.
And this is the area that's now between, say, Fairbanks Lumber and the Gavora Mall, kind of in that area.
I
mean, that's definitely considered in town now.
That's right.
Tell me the story about the street names in Slaterville.
Well, the streets are named after the Slater family. Their Minnie Street was Charlie's first wife, and Clara Street was the second wife. Betty Street is named after the daughter. And, well, they're all named after relatives. I really don't know all of them. And, of course, Well Street that we live on was named after because of the only well at that time that Mike Ersig had at the end of Well Street. So they
really?
Just called it Well Street.
Huh.
And that's why it got its name.
My goodness. Well, who worked on your house?
Well, the contractor on the house was Dale family, Henry Dale. They were an old-time family here, too. And the finish work, the papering and the painting inside and outside was done by Andrew Norton and either his brother or his cousin Tom was his name. And they did all the interior finish.
Huh. So you moved in what year?
In June of 1940.
That must have been nice.
It was beautiful. Everything was finished, drapes hung, everything was done.
And here we are 45 years later, and you are still in the same
house. We're still in the same house. Of course, it's a little larger. With six children, we had to expand the house as we expanded the family.
Uh-huh. Well, about that time, we're moving into the war years, of course. How did the war years change Fairbanks?
Well, when the war years changed Fairbanks, of course, a great deal, because we had so many military coming in, and housing was, of course, that was before I was in the real estate business, but when Ladd Field was started, Gaffney was here, and he sent for help from Washington, D.C., for secretarial help and other help, and there were six girls came from Washington, D.C., and one of them happened to be a friend of ours who had gone to school, to business school with my wife in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, where they went to business school. So she and a girlfriend moved in with us because everybody took in, we were expected to take in somebody to provide housing. So at, when the morning that, on December 7, 1941, the girls were still with us, and then Gaffney sent in a car immediately when the news came out of the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and we couldn't imagine what they were there so early in the morning for at our place to get Eleanor and this girl that was staying, because they were both employed at Ladd Field, and Eleanor was Gaffney's secretary. So they took them out there, and then we heard the news that, you know, Pearl Harbor had been bombed, and so the girls weren't allowed to leave the base then, and only they sent in for some clothes for them so they could stay on base. So then they had to move out there, and so they moved out, and then we were expected to take in others, and we had an engineer one time, and then we had two engineers at one time stayed with us, and then we had one older fellow who stayed with us for quite some time during those years. And, of course, we had children, and we had a two-bedroom house, so it was a little cramped, but, everybody felt they should do what they could, which we all did.
Well, how did you feel during those years? Was it scary or exciting, or did you...
It wasn't... I suppose it might have been scary, but, you know, we had the blackout, and everybody had... To black out your windows, you and Fairbanks was just as dark as it could be. It was dark enough just with the dark, but everything was blacked out. And we took turns patrolling the neighborhoods to see that everybody's windows were covered and that there was no light showing. And so I was one of the patrollers in our area for a while. We took turns.
Did you ever have a circumstance where someone's light was showing and there was any trouble? What did you do?
We didn't have any trouble. We just go and tell them that they hadn't covered them quite well enough to cover them.
So not even the littlest speck of light could be showing?
No, they had everything just blacked out, and you'd be downtown, and I know my wife would get through work and then try to get to the butcher shop or someplace to go and buy something that we needed at home, and she went one time, thought she was going in the butcher shop and got into a bar instead. Those kind of things happened. And,
because it was about this time of year when it was...
It was in December.
December?
When Pearl Harbor. But
then, and no daylight, practically.
And, of course, there wasn't any daylight anyway, so it was dark on the streets, and it was worse when there was no lights showing from the windows of any of the stores or homes, so you could see to get around.
What was Christmas like that year?
Christmas was fine. We had everything blacked out, and of course we had the small children, and we had our tree, and mm-hmm. it was quiet.
Uh-huh. Now, during these years in the 40s, where are you working? What were you doing there?
Well, when I left, when the war came, then the FEC did stay open for 2 years. Of course, they could no longer afford to stay open, and anyway, because they couldn't compete with the wages that were being paid by the military and the federal government for their workers. So the FE closed down, and they had asked me to stay on because they wanted somebody to watch the building, and they had leased part of the buildings to the military. But I decided that I didn't want to do that, so I got a job in town with what at that time was Pollock Airlines, who later sold to Alaska Airlines. And it's interesting that when I went to work for Pollock Airlines, one of your first guests on Meet a Pioneer was also working there. Hutch was working for
Is that right?
Pollock Airlines at the time. Then I went from there to the drugstore for a while. And in 46, I went into the real estate business with Ken Murray.
Gee whiz. Now, we're going to get into the real estate business part of your life in just a moment. But during the war years, the Russians, there were a lot of Russian people here. Tell me why, and I understand they were living near you. Tell me some of the circumstances and your encounters.
Well, the Russians were moved into the housing that the military had rented from the FE company. And of course, those homes are just a block or block and a half from us. And they lived there, and we had them for neighbors. And, of course, they were brought here because all of the, at that time, it was called Lend-Lease, and the planes were being flown here through Montana and delivered to the Russians at Ladd Field. And they had this, they had quite a contingent of Russians living here. And we had them for neighbors, and they were pleasant enough, and they'd come through the neighborhood and walk, and we noticed that they always went off a mini street, which and made a little detour around, and they were very fond of the pets we had, and Wilbur and Thelma Walker were our neighbors, and Eddie and Murdy Boggan, and we all had, well, we had a little dog, Walker's had a little Scotty, and we had a few chickens, and the Boggans had some rabbits, and one morning when Russians, a bunch of them were leaving, and when they left, the same morning that they left, we missed all of these pets. So we finally decided that the Russians must have taken them, and my wife at that time was working for the district attorney's office, and she told them there, you know, what we thought had happened, and they said, oh, we'll get them off the plane, we'll find out. Well, when they went to find out or try to get on the plane, once the planes were turned over to the Russians, nobody got on them. So the marshal's office here said, well, we'll stop them at Nome then. We'll have them search them at Nome. Well, the same thing happened over there. There was no access to the plane, so we didn't know, you know, for sure, but we were definitely sure the Russians had taken.
They just took your pets.
We took them and
they took your dogs, your chickens, your
rabbits. Uh-huh.
All your neighbors.
Well, three of us that all missed.
And you went out that morning and they were just gone.
They were just nowhere to be found.
What do you think they took them for?
Well, we really don't know, but if you read Major Jordan's diary, which we have gone, my wife had it republished last year, and in that, there's in one of the chapters, it tells the Russians how to get four-legged animals out of the United States, so that must have been part of their program when they were here. We really don't know, but that's where those pets went.
That is fascinating. I'm reading those as a result of our conversation the other day, and those are amazing diaries. There's a lot going on here in those years. there was one other story that we'll tell in just a moment. We're going to take a break for a couple more sponsors, and we'll be back with Earl Cook on Meet a Pioneer.
Alaska's pioneering spirit will never die. It lives on in second and third generation Alaskans like Dr. Carol Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic.
Sponsoring Meet a Pioneer gives Carol an opportunity to show her pride in being an Alaskan and in being a member of the world's largest drugless healing profession. Becoming a chiropractor meant years of demanding study, a period of internship, and then meeting tough licensing standards. She's happy to talk about chiropractic with anyone interested in learning more about it. Just call 479-0485 or stop by and see Carol at 3525 College Road.
Thank you, Dr. Davis of Denali Chiropractic Clinic. And now back to our program, Meet a Pioneer.
We're back with Mr. Earl Cook on Meet a Pioneer. Well, there's some more stories about the Russians being here. How many years, by the way, Earl, were they in this area for that program?
Oh, at least 4 years.
Uh-huh.
I don't recall just how many years, but they were here probably a good 4 years.
Were they all flyers then?
Well, a lot of them were flyers, and they had other personnel here other than flyers. Of course, they had mechanics on the base,
uh-huh.
And you get Randy Acord to tell you about that sometime, the troubles they had with tools disappearing on the base.
Oh, really? Was there much social interaction?
They were not supposed to, the Russians were not supposed to do too much social interacting, and the officers or the pilots were not supposed to date any of the American women.
Oh, that was orders, huh?
Those were part of their orders, apparently, and we had some interesting experiences with them. We were all young, group of us younger ones were out one night at what we called the International Hotel across the river, and while we were there, a group of Russians came. There were four Russians and one American pilot, and he was a captain. We noticed them come in and take a booth in the back, and carrying, we noticed the waiters and waitresses carrying the vodka and drinks back to this group, and a young fellow from Fairbanks who was in the military was a chauffeur for this group of Russians, and he, of course, in the course of the evening, he came over and talked to us. He danced with my wife and told us a little bit, and he told us that these Russians weren't supposed to be seeing any American women, and...
What is his name? To spell?
His name was Johnny White.
Uh-huh.
And we knew the family and knew his mother very well. Anyway, they finally in the evening they left but the American was so drunk they had to carry him out. The Russians took him out, kind of let him out, and the next day, Johnny apparently was still chauffeuring the Russians, but he disappeared, and they finally found his body out by Blaine Lake, and the Russians claimed that they had wanted to go pick wildflowers, and Johnny had driven them out there, and that while they were picking flowers, whatever they were doing, he had taken his clothes off and gone swimming. Well, his mother had said that Johnny was afraid of the water and didn't know how to swim anyway, so that was a little doubtful, but then they drained the lake and did find his body, but nothing was ever done. I'm sure, and as a lot of other people are, that Johnny didn't drown, that he was put away, but...
Because he knew something
he shouldn't have known. There's a fellow who was in the intelligence here at the time, Ed Fortier in Anchorage, and he's been, for 40-some years, he's been following this story, and he wants to publish, he has written it, and he wants to publish it, but... brother of John, who is still living, Ed contacted him, and he doesn't really want him to publish it because apparently in Ed's story or somewhere in the investigation that was said that Johnny's mother was an alcoholic, and the brother doesn't really want that to come out, so that that has never been followed through. But I wish Ed would publish his story someday.
I'm sure it would be fascinating. Very interesting. Well, you mentioned a few minutes ago that you... This was a surprise to me, but you got into business with Ken Murray.
That's right.
I didn't realize that. And what were the circumstances there?
Well, Ken, and one day, I was still working at the drugstore, and his office was right above, and one day he came and asked me if I'd like to go to work for him because, there wasn't any future where I was. And Mary Foran, who was an old-timer here also, had been working for Ken, and she was leaving, and he wanted somebody, so that's...
And what was his business at the time?
Real estate and insurance.
Both, okay.
He had both, yes.
So you did go to work for him, and that was what year?
46.
46, uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And I was with Ken until 1949, and then he decided he no longer wanted to have both businesses, so he asked me if I wanted to take over the real estate, and he'd keep the insurance, so then I opened my own office in what was then the Lacey Street Hotel.
Is that right? 1949 then?
Yes, in 1949.
And he went off with Ken Murray Insurance, you were Earl Cook Realty.
That's right.
Huh. Well, that must have been kind of exciting to have gone for several years without really knowing what you were going to end up doing.
And it was a relief, really, to finally have something that was bringing in a little money and giving us a little better living. And, of course, we really needed it with the children coming.
In addition to it being a more secure financial situation, did you like real estate? Was it fun?
Yes, I had always been interested in real estate ever since we came here because there were so many interesting places, and well, it just looked like it would be a good idea to own something, and having had nothing in my life, I just felt I liked to own and be more secure, and real estate looked like a good way to do it.
What was the market like then? Were there other realty companies around?
There was none then. The next one that opened really was Myers Real Estate.
So you were the first?
Yes.
Aside from Ken Murray's?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Is that right?
Ken had the same opportunity that I did because Hosey Ross had real estate and the undertaking business, and that's when Ken went in with Hosey, and then from there he branched into real estate and insurance. So.
Golly. Well, what was real estate like in 1949 when you took it over?
Well, actually, there was a crunch. You know, there was a real need for housing in before I was in real estate business, and that was when the war broke out. Then we had another crunch, housing crunch in 46, 47, 48. And it was really, housing was short, and, you know, you could sell anything. If you could find something, you know, that people wanted to sell, it was very easy to sell it because we had people, workers, not only military, but workers on Ladfield and Eielson who needed housing. And then you had other workers who were connected with the firms that were working on the highway, because that highway was being built at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
I can give you an example of how short housing was. I had showed one house over in the old Derby Tract area to two colonels from the base, and of course, you know, the first time you show people something, they don't say, well, I'm going to take it. But it happened that both of these colonels had looked at it, and they both came back to my office at the same time and said, they both said they wanted the house. Well, I said, you know, you both looked at it, and you're both here, and I don't know what to say which one of you can have it. And they said, oh, we'll settle that. So they just flipped. And they said, whoever heads wins, tails loses. And that's the way they settled on who was going to have the house. You can see how short housing was then.
Oh, gosh. Huh. Well, how about transactions? How did people, how about the loan situation? How did people finance their homes?
Of course, when in those years, everything was sold on a contract of sale. The mortgages and deeds of trust hadn't come in yet.
Meaning it was a transaction between the buyer and the seller directly?
Well, yes, they could. It was a much more personal relationship then, and you knew, you know, you usually knew your, at least the sellers, you knew most of those people, and it was a contract of sale, and the sellers would tell you how much they wanted down, how much a month, and, you know, how long it was going to take to pay off, and that was the way really real estate was handled, because the banks did not make loans to finance real estate. If you had enough to satisfy the bank, you had enough to satisfy for the down payment. So that's the way it was for a good many years.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some interesting experiences in that, because, you know, when you get a house one of my first ones was a couple that had been here for years and years, Hattie and Jack McPhee, and they wanted to buy a house, he worked for the railroad, and that was in the 50s. And Hattie, I showed them homes, and when Hattie decided the one she wanted, and she said, well, how do they want to be paid for it? And I said, well, Hattie, they want cash. And, that was fine with her. Well, of course, I meant, you know, the seller wanted to be cashed out. Well, she took me literally, and when she came in to pay for the house, she brought me a paper bag with $10,500 in it to pay for this house. So I was a little upset with that, but I told her, I said, well, Hattie, you didn't have to do this. Well, you said you wanted cash, so here it is. So it was interesting because a few years later, she wanted to sell the house. And, of course, by that time, the price had gone up. And so I thought, I'll get even with Hattie. So, of course, she wanted cash when she left, but she didn't. She really didn't. By that time, she knew she didn't mean that it had to be in bills, so... Anyway, when I sold it for her, it was a little bit more than she paid for it, quite a bit more. I took her the money the same way, and I said, Hattie, here's your money in cash. So.
It sounds like you got very close to your clients in those days.
Well, yes. When I first went in the real estate business, of course, we handled a lot of rentals, and it was an altogether different ball game, because you really felt obligated to your clients. And a lot of the rentals, the people would, you know, they'd rent their house for the winter because they were going to go out. Well, you felt obligated to take care of the houses. So in those days, there weren't many of the houses that had oil heat. You either had wood or you had coal to fire your furnaces. So it was a night and day job, because if between tenants, I would have to go out and either fill the stoker or stoke the furnace with wood and keep the house from freezing up. It was just a different ball game, and it wasn't until oil heat came that a lot of the homes got oil heat that you didn't have to worry so much about them, because it was more automatic and take care of themselves, unless something, power went off or something, and then you'd have to get up and run over and be sure nothing froze up.
But it was a
different deal than it is now.
We're going to take a break to acknowledge more of our Meet a Pioneer sponsors. We'll be back with Mr. Earl Cook in just a couple of minutes.
KFAR, best sound on.
When Roy Larson started Larson's Jewelers on that day back in 1946, he had big dreams of what he'd like his business to become. Over the years, some of those dreams changed and others came true. Today, Larson's is still a family-owned business and one of the finest and most complete jewelry stores in the interior. Almost 40 years of skill and experience go into everything they do. Like Fairbanks, they've grown, but they're still your friend and neighbor. Larson's, fine jeweler since 1946 at 405 Noble.
He is waiting for you.
Today's Alaskans are demanding more. More style, more options, more flexibility, and more for their money. And they're finally getting it from Sophie's Station, Fairbanks' newest, most attractive contemporary living complex. Sophie's Station is a prestigious addition to our community, designed for optimum quality, comfort, and convenience. For adult living at its best, see the new one- and two-bedroom units, now available at Sophie's Station.
Alaska is still a land of pioneers, like the Binkley family, who for three generations have operated riverboats in the state of Alaska.
Running the riverboat Discovery has given our family the opportunity to show so many others just a little corner of the Alaska we love. That's also one of the reasons we're proud to be a sponsor of Meet a Pioneer. This program gives us all a chance to find out more about the fascinating history of this special place we call Alaska, and we look forward to each week's program. We're looking forward to seeing you again next summer aboard the riverboat Discovery.
And it's Mr. Jim Binkley who will be a guest on Meet a Pioneer one of these days. And in fact, I'll have to get him before their season starts or their family will get too busy. We're back with Mr. Earl Cook on Meet a Pioneer. Well, real estate really was different then. What was another story you have about selling?
Well, in the more recent years, after the deeds of trust came in, and we had some out-of-town people looking for real estate, but this one was kind of interesting, I thought, because some people from Anchorage contacted us and said they wanted to buy a piece of property either on Airport Road or College Road, and they were going to open an electronics shop. So a fellow looked at piece I had on College, decided on piece on College Road, and he made an earnest money payment on it, and it was three lots and a house and a garage on it. So he left and went back to Anchorage, and then he called and said his wife would be up to pay for the property, and we didn't know whether she was flying up or how she was coming, and my wife was in the office, and we were down on 3rd Avenue then, and there was, I had a fellow working for me. Now we were in the office when she came, and her name was Steinhelpert, and she came in and said she wanted to pay off the, close out the sale on this property, and so she said, do you have a little office where we can meet? And I said, yeah, we can go in my office in here and go in there. So she went out the car and came back with a beer case, and the balance that she owed on the property was $85,000. She opened the beer case, and here was $85,000 in bills. So I thought, my God, it's almost 3 o'clock. The banks are going to be closed, you know. But my wife was there. So I called Alaska National Bank, where we had our trust account, and asked Cartwright, Bill Cartwright was there at the time. I said, Bill, you got a couple of tellers will be available in a few minutes because I want to make a deposit. And I said, I think you're going to need a couple extra tellers. And I said, because it's about closing time. But we had to count that money in the office, take it to the bank, and then they had to count it. And, of course, it ran past their 3 o'clock closing time. But that was one of the interesting things I thought that that happened. But she drove all the way from Anchorage with that money in her car, in a beer case.
Oh, my gosh.
And there was $85,000.
Well, you got very involved in the lives and took personal care of some of your clients. There's an interesting story about Lena Ferguson. Would you tell us that?
Yes, Lena was one of the gals who had been on the line, or was on the line at the time. I was still living there, had a little log cabin. And she was a patient of Dr. Haglund, and Lena had had an accident. She was, by that time, she was quite elderly and quite ill, and she lived in this little cabin. All she had for running water was a hand pump. Well, it seemed Haglund told her one day to get a hold of me to take care of her property for her and to help her sell something so she could pay her bills, because she had been in the hospital. She had fallen, and the hot plate had fallen across her breast and burned her, and Haglund took care of her. So he decided to tell her to get a hold of me, and so I did go down to see her, and it was pitiful the way she lived. And she told me about her properties and which ones she wanted to sell, and I did sell a piece of her property on 3rd Avenue, off the line, of course. That was down by Dunkel Street. And when I got the money for it, I told her, I said, "Now, Lena, I'll pay your bills, but there's going to be money left over." I paid all her hospital and doctor bills. And I said, "There's some money left over. Now, what do you want me to do with it?" "Earl, you bring it to me." She says, "I just love to run that through my fingers." So I said, "Well, Lena, I hate to have you have this money here because somebody hit you over the head, and take it." "Oh, no, I'll be all right. You bring me the money." Well, I went every day to check on her because I really was concerned about her. This went on for several months. And it, of course, about that was the time the urban renewal was coming in, so they wanted to take her property on 4th Avenue, so we were battling with the urban renewal on that and trying to get more money than they had offered her. But anyway, I went down to the cabin, and I found Lena Lane there, and I immediately called Haglund, then I called the ambulance, and also that was done, and Haglund came, and he wanted me to... I told him, and he just took one look at Lena, and he said, "Well, she's gone, Earl." And he said, "Yeah, I want to show you what a job I did in patching her up after she got burned." He flipped over and I'd gone and showed me the job he did on when he was taking care of her after she had burned her breast. Well, then when they came to get Lena, and then I didn't want to go through her things because I knew she had this money there, and I didn't want to be held responsible for having taken any money. So I called U.S. Marshal, who was Lodessa Nordale, and told her the circumstances, and she said she'd send somebody right down, which she did. And we found the money cashed all over there, in the pillowcases, under the mattress, and in the hot casing of the hot water bottle. We just found it everywhere. And most of it was there. Nobody had taken any money, and Lena did die of natural causes. But in the course of my taking care of Lena and watching out for her, she had told me she knew she was ill. And she said, "Earl, I want to go home to die." And I said, "Well, Lena, where is your home?" And it was New York. And I said, "Well, do you have any relatives there?" "And yes, I have two brothers there." So we got the addresses of the brothers and then sent them word that Lena wanted to come home. And I explained to them that she could pay her own way and she was ill, but she wanted to come home. She said that's where she wanted to die. Well, we didn't get any response, and then she wanted me to send a telegram, which I did, and we get no response. So by that time, I had their addresses. So after I did finally, I didn't know quite what to do, but I finally decided to let the brothers know, and I had the telephone number for one of them, and I hesitated about calling him or notifying him, but I finally decided I'd call him, and I was at home at the time, and I called him and told him that Lena had died, and the first thing he said to me, "Well, did she leave any money?" And I said, "USOB," and hung up, because he wouldn't pay any attention to her when she was living or help her out. So anyway, he did call me back, and in the course of the conversation, he wanted to know if Lena could have a Jewish funeral. Well, I didn't know anything about Jewish funerals, but I said, "Well, I don't know. I can try to arrange it." So there was a fellow here who was head of USO by the name of Frank Hill, and I knew he was Jewish, and Bob Bloom, one of our old-timers, was here. And so they said, yeah, they would arrange the funeral, and they did, and we had the funeral in the chapel on 1st Avenue, and, of course, the gals from the line were all there, and they put on a good show. And then when we got out to the cemetery to bury Lena, they came up to me finally and said, "Earl, we're short one pallbearer, and could you help us?" And I said, "Well, I don't have any white gloves, and I don't have, you know, the little skull cap they were wearing." "Well, you know, come on anyway." And I said, "Sure, fine." And so I did, and I went and helped them and buried Lena. And, of course, I was executor of her estate, so I had to. And we followed it through and settled with Urban Renewal and got the money for the property on 4th Avenue, plus what other money she had. And I just hated to have to send it out to those brothers, but that's where it had to go, so that's where it went.
While she was still living near the end of her life, she expressed an interest in leaving everything to you.
She did, yes, but I told her I didn't want her money. If she was going to change her will, I asked her to leave it to local charity. And, of course, my local charity wasn't exactly a charity, but I would have been Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouts. That's just a fascinating story about Lena Ferguson. The Boy Scouts, now how'd you get... We've got just a few minutes left, but that's a wonderful story of your family's involvement in Boy Scouts.
Well, I got involved in Boy Scouts, of course, before our boys were old enough to be in Boy Scouts. I was active in civic affairs in Fairbanks and in the Junior Chamber of Commerce, and so they had called me to be on the board of the Boy Scouts, the executive board, which I did, and got involved in boards of review and different phases of scouting. And then when the boys were old enough, they got into Cub Scouting, and I was first president of the PTA at Nordale School, and that was about the time we formed PAC 222, and I had no intention of being a Cub Master, but I ended up as Cub Master of PAC 222, and of course, my wife got involved as a den mother, and so we've been involved in scouting ever since. But one of the things that I'm very fond of remembering about scouting is in the early years when I was Cub Master of PAC 222, and I had never been a scout, so I knew nothing about scouting, but we had a lot of fun, and they had these contests among the scouts every year to see which pack was going to get first place, and they had to put a display in a downtown store window. So the place we got for our pack was Nerland's Big Window on 3rd Avenue. And we did have first place for several years, and always at Nerland's.
Oh.
So there's more of a connection between your pioneers, you know, than just being in Fairbanks. It's the history goes back.
Of your six children, all of them were involved in Girl Scouting and Boy Scouting, and your three boys were all Eagle Scouts?
Yes.
And your grandsons?
And we have four grandsons who are Eagle Scouts, one fifth one coming up.
To be, really, that's just a lovely story. And, of course, last year you were honored by the Midnight Sun Boy Scout Council as the first distinguished citizen.
Yes, that's right.
That's wonderful. It's a fascinating story. You are the patriarch of the Cook family in Fairbanks.
Yeah, I think so.
It's been a great pleasure having you on Meet a Pioneer this morning, Mr. Earl Cook.
Thank you, Gail. That's all, Gail. I appreciate being on the program, and I think the program is very interesting. I hope it continues. My dad, you're a wonderful hostess, too.
You've been listening to Meet a Pioneer. A taped version of this interview will become a part of the permanent oral history collection of the Alaska and Polar Regions Department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This program was produced by Gail Malloy.
Hey, that's okay with me.
Whirlpool makes it easier for you.
Whirlpool knows it's hard to have time to cook and still have time to do the things you want. That's why we promise to build quality microwave ovens designed to make your world a little easier. Our quick defrost cycle helps thaw food in a hurry. And with our balanced wave cooking system, your quick meals never tasted so good. Whirlpool, making your world a little easier.
That was fast.
We're making the world a little easier.
I have time to make dessert.
Whirlpool makes it easier.